Open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 2. Yesterday, Tracy and I stained our fence in our backyard. What job that should have taken a couple hours took all day, and everything went wrong. Everything went wrong. The color, the equipment we were using didn't work. The color that we picked out turned out to be much different than what we wanted. Multiple trips back to Home Depot because we kept running out. At the end, when we were finally done, there were big missed spots that we noticed and problems, and we had this ended up with this ridiculous orange fence now. And yet, even with all that, I found myself at the very end standing back and looking at the whole thing and having a sense of satisfaction in a job completed. You notice I didn't say a job well done, but completed nonetheless. We do that after we've done some major task because ingrained inside us is deeply is a desire to, not so much for work, a desire for accomplishment. We take satisfaction in that because God takes satisfaction in accomplishment. And this morning we're going to look at the satisfaction that God took in the completion of the creation on day 7. We ended last time with the end of day 6 with what some have called the cultural mandate when God commanded that we subdue the earth and rule. And that gives meaning to all of the arts and sciences and really to all work. And it's carried to its greatest extension when Christ gave the Great Commission. And I didn't get into this last time, but it's an interesting thought, the blessing on Christ's followers that enabled them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth spiritually at the Great Commission. Well, now we arrive at day 7, and it spills into chapter 2, verse 1. It says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished all the work He had been doing, so on the seventh day He rested from all His work. And God blessed the seventh day, and He made it holy, because on it He rested from all the work of creating that He had done." When the chapter and verse divisions were put into the Bible in the Middle Ages, they got off to a terrible start with the very first chapter division. These verses really belong in chapter 1. They're part of the chapter 1 creation week. They form an amazing conclusion, not only in the Hebrew structure, but also conceptually. The account started, you remember, with the quiet, serene stillness of the setting of the motionless pre-creation world where nothing is happening except for the Spirit of God hovering over the waters. The picture was purposely very serene in contrast to the pagan myths, which started out with the chaos of fighting between the gods and the pagan gods and the forces of chaos. And so there's a contrast to that, and it's very, very quiet. And then comes the flurry of activity as the creation burst into life during the creation week, during the 6 days. And now on day 7, we return right back to the quietness and tranquility of God's rest. So verse 1 starts with a summary of the first 6 days. It says, "Thus the heavens and earth were completed in all their vast array." Literally, it should say this. Thus, the three things, the heavens and the earth and their hosts were completed. The heavens and the earth and their hosts. Heavens and earth refers to everything that was made in days 1 through 3, first 3 days. Their hosts, their armies, literally, refers to everything that was made in the last 3 days when God was filling everything. Everything is done now. Everything has its function. It exists and it's carrying out its purpose. And the heavens and the earth and their legions and their parts, every little bit of it was good and completed and in place by the end of day 6. But the creation week was not over. There's still one more day. And we talked about how the day 6 was emphasized. Day 7 is emphasized even more. Day 6 is climactic part of the creation. Day 7 is a much greater climax. And it's showcased in the poetic lines. I'm not going to get into the structure, but it's very wonderful and beautiful. The seventh day is repeated 3 times in the center of 3 consecutive lines. But it's interesting. He doesn't use Sabbath day. You never see the phrase Sabbath day, which was the normal Jewish way to refer to the last day of the week. They didn't have any other way to refer to it. They didn't have a word like Saturday. They just always called it Sabbath. And of all contexts, when you would expect to see the phrase Sabbath day, you would think it would be here when God is establishing the very concept of Sabbath rest. He does use the word Sabbath. The word translated rest is Shabbat, the Hebrew word Sabbath, but you don't see the phrase Sabbath day, just the plain, colorless, ordinary day 7 3 times. Now, why is that? Some of the pagans believed that the gods did what they did on the Sabbath day because it was the Sabbath day. The thing you have to understand about the pagan religion is they believed you have mankind, and then above that you have the gods, and then above that you have nature. And the gods are subject to nature. There's something higher than the gods. And so if it's the Sabbath day, the gods have to respond to that. And so they do what they do on the Sabbath because it's the Sabbath. But for God, the true God, that's not the case. It's not the Sabbath until He makes it the Sabbath. Until then, it's just nothing. It's just another day. Until God declares it holy, there's nothing special about it. The only thing that makes it special is God saying that it's special. Just as at the creation of the sun and the moon, you never see the words sun or moon, because those were names of pagan gods, so in the creation of the Sabbath day, the phrase Sabbath day is never used. And it shows us that nothing is special until God makes it special. And God's not subject to anything. The Bible doesn't say why God chose a seven-day cycle of time. Possibly, though, it's to show that He's supreme above the cycles of nature, since there's no other explanation for a seven-day cycle. I mean, the year, we have a year because of the time it takes us to go around the sun. We have a day because of the time it takes the earth to turn around once. We have months because of the cycle of the moon. But why the week? Why do we have a seven-day week universally? I mean, the world can't agree on anything else. The world can't agree on a system of measurement. The world can't agree on a single language or a single currency or anything else. Anytime you don't have something that's dictated by the heavens, then there's a wide variety of different methods around the world in different cultures, except for a seven-day week, which is universal. How do we explain that? There's no celestial explanation for it, and there's no mathematical explanation for it either. I don't know if you thought about that, but nobody in his right mind would have sat down and said, hey, let's divide a 365-year into sevens. I mean, there's no reason you'd do that. Sevens don't even fit into a month very well. I think what happened is God picked a number that can have absolutely no other explanation, made it universal, so that He could illustrate His supremacy over the universe. What He says goes. And things are determined not ultimately by the sun and the moon, but by God's decree. So, verses 2 and 3 are going to make three statements about the seventh day. Each one gives insight into the significance of God's rest. Look at verse 2. By the seventh day, God had finished all the work He'd been doing. And so the first point we see here is completion. The phrase, His work, is repeated three times, emphasizing the fact that God alone did it. It was His work alone. And it says, when it says that He took rest, one of the things we have to understand about that is that simply means to cease work. That's all it means. It doesn't mean to be refreshed. It just means to stop working. God made a clear ending point to the creation. It was not left open-ended. The world is not presently in the process of being created. That's one reason why we know that Genesis 1 is not some kind of figurative description of a natural process. When people suggest that God brought about the creation by means of natural processes that are still going on today, they're forgetting the fact that on day 7, God put an end to the creation. It's not ongoing. God did not use gravity or the laws of motion or any other physical laws to create the world. We know that because those physical laws are still ongoing today. But whatever God used to create the world stopped at day 7. So He stopped His work. Now we think of rest in the sense of being tired, because that's usually why we stop our work, because we're tired. But God, of course, doesn't get tired. Isaiah 40, He never is weary. He doesn't sleep because He doesn't need rest. He can't be depleted in any way because He has infinite energy. God can do anything as easily as He can do any other thing. The reason God ceased His work wasn't because of weariness. It's very simple. The reason God ceased His work was because there was nothing left to do. It was all done. He had created and created and created until He was utterly satisfied. And then He stopped because it had reached the point exactly as it was supposed to be. It's rest in the sense of cessation, not as a result of fatigue, but just for the purpose of enjoyment, of accomplishment, and celebration of completion. Now, can you imagine that? What that creation was like at that time and God's enjoyment of it? Given the battle scars that the creation bears because of the ravages of sin and the curse, I don't know if it's possible for us to even imagine what that paradise was like. But the creation at this point, even today, is still wonderful, even to the point of taking our breath away at times. But nothing like it was. But even in today, I mean, you just go to the most wonderful, beautiful setting on the planet, and still, it isn't perfect. There's something, as Larry Crabb likes to say, there's something wrong with everything in this cursed world. At the dawn of day 7, there was nothing wrong with anything. With anything. When God said it was very good, that included every star and every galaxy, every little molecule, every cell of every organism, every system, every piece of every system. Every last part was good. Every combination of elements was good. Every relationship between the combination of systems of elements was good. All the relationships, everything, every whole, every piece, all of it was good. We take a walk through the woods and we can smell the flowers and hear the birds and see the trees and see the beauty of it and be overwhelmed with how wonderful the creation is. But think of how limited that enjoyment of the creation really is. For one thing, there's something wrong with every one of those things. They're not perfect. And the whole thing can be kind of diminished by, you know, just stepping on a thistle or getting bit by a mosquito or something. And our ability, not only that, but our ability to appreciate the beauty that is there is limited. Our knowledge of it is limited. Not only that, we can only be in one place at a time and we can only think about one thing at a time. We can appreciate some aspects of some of the parts, but only God can appreciate the whole. He's the only one that can back up far enough to see the whole painting. Imagine the enjoyment of God at that time. Everything was perfect. Nothing was bad. It was a paradise. Everything produced enjoyment. And He alone could fully understand and appreciate everything about everything simultaneously. And He could enjoy all the brilliant color of every flower from every perspective, every angle. He had every perspective on every wonderful thing. He enjoyed unbroken fellowship with the man and the woman that He had created. Job gives us a little glimpse into the mood in heaven at that point in Job 38:7. You remember it says, when He laid the foundation of the earth, the sons of God shouted for joy. Reflecting the disposition of God Himself, talking about the angels, Psalm 104:31 talks about God rejoicing in all His works. In 1989, two Harvard astronomers discovered the Great Wall with capital letters. It's capitalized because it was the greatest thing ever discovered. It was a wall of thousands of galaxies stretching hundreds of millions of light years across the known universe, and it was called the largest single coherent structure seen so far in nature. A wall of galaxies. 3 months later, in 1990, God opened up another little window for the astronomers, and they saw more than a dozen of those walls. And they were so vast, so large, and suggested a structure to the universe so regular and immense that it defied the current theories of cosmic origins. And that pattern of galactic walls absolutely dwarfed the Great Wall, now written with lowercase letters. It was only capitalized for 3 months. And they found something bigger. And I don't know what kind of arrangement the galaxies are in, whether all those walls form one little piece of one little brick of one giant structure or something. I mean, we have no idea what all God has done, but I can guess this, that the view from heaven must be something else. Awesome beyond comprehension. It is good, it is good, it is good, it is very good. Those are descriptions of enjoyment and pleasure. Can you imagine the look that the Son and the Father gave each other when a million fully formed galaxies exploded into existence at their command? It was all for them. Hebrews 2:10 says, God, for whom and through whom everything exists. Everything is for God, and He created it for Himself. Colossians 1:15, He's the image of the invisible God, and all things were created by Him and for Him. Romans 11:36, for from Him and through Him and to Him are all things. Isaiah 43:21, the people I formed for Myself. Revelation 4:11, everything was created for His pleasure. So God took satisfaction in His creation on the seventh day. But let's go to the next step, because there's so much more to it than just Him taking satisfaction. There's more to the concept of rest. You might ask yourself, why is the rest holy? Why is the seventh day the only one that's holy? What is so, the word holy means special. What's so special about inactivity? You know, we tend to think of inactivity as being ordinary and work as being special. So why does He say that rest is what's special? And on top of that, why in what sense could we say that God rested anyway when on the seventh day he did the same thing he did all the other 6 days? All he did in the other 6 days was speak. And then he speaks on the seventh day too. What we need to understand is that there's so much more to this concept of rest than inactivity, especially when associated with God. The word rest is later used in Scripture to describe a situation of coming to be settled or established in an area, like the Israelites being established and settled in the Promised Land. When it's applied to a king, the idea of being established and settled carries the idea of being enthroned. A king, after having picked a new capital and establishing his palace and setting up his throne, and then sitting in that throne and setting and beginning officially his rule from that throne, they would say he came to rest there. He took his rest there. That's how they use the term. The universe is God's palace, and all the elements of creation are simply functionaries in that palace. Psalm 104 talks about that. Just little pieces of the palace. And there are several psalms that pick up on the idea that the created universe functions as a resting place, the established, enduring throne of God. It was created as His throne. Psalm 93:1 is one of them. Yahweh reigns. He's robed in majesty. The world is firmly established. It cannot be moved. The world is His throne. Your throne is established long ago. You are from all eternity. In Psalm 132, we see that God is resting place is equivalent to His throne. In verse 13 it says, "For Yahweh has chosen Zion, He has desired it for His dwelling. This is my resting place forever and ever. Here I will sit enthroned, for I have desired it." Now, let's add another thought to this. The throne, or the palace of the deity, was always a temple in the ancient world. It was referred to as a temple. As soon as the readers saw this terminology in Genesis 2 about God's rest, immediately in their minds, first thing they would have thought of was God creating the whole creation as one giant temple. Because in that culture, the purpose of a temple was for the deity to come to rest. That was the purpose of building the temple, was for a place of rest for the deity. Not of relaxation, but a place to establish His throne. And when God created the sun and the moon and the stars, we recall that He never used the word sun and moon. He just called them lamps and used the very word lamp that's used for the lamps that light up the temple. In creating the universe, God was creating a temple. In chapter 2, we see the Garden of Eden described as in terms of the holy place and the duties of mankind described in terms of priestly duties. And so for 6 days now, what God's been doing is constructing His temple. The earthly temple building in Jerusalem was built so that tiny little human beings could have a little model of God's temple that they could see. It's small enough. But God didn't want anybody to get the wrong idea about that. It's just a little model. Isaiah 66:1 says, "This is what Yahweh says, heaven is my throne and earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you will build for me? Where will my resting place be?" God's true throne, His true resting place, is not in a building, it's the universe. As we continue to read in the first 5 books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, books of Moses, we find something very interesting. There's a parallel in the language used for the construction of the temple and the language used in Genesis 1, and it's very striking. I wish we could take a lot of time on this, but let me just give you a few examples. Exodus 39, thus was completed all the work. Genesis 2:1, thus was completed the heavens. Identical structures in the Hebrew, each one of these. Exodus 39:43, Moses saw all that they had done, and it was just as Yahweh instructed. Genesis 1, God saw all that He has done, and it was very good. When Moses saw all the completed work, He blessed them, just as God blessed, as he saw. At the very end of the construction of the tabernacle, Exodus 40, and Moses finished the work, Genesis 2:2, and God finished the work. The language is used the same because what they're constructing is a replica of what God was constructing in Genesis 1, God's dwelling place. And none of this comes as any surprise because we understand that the earthly tabernacle was built after a certain pattern. Now listen carefully. You may want to flip over to Hebrews 8 because I'll look at that in just a second, but listen carefully to Exodus 25. When God was giving the instructions for the tabernacle and the temple, He said, "Then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them. Make this tabernacle and its furnishings exactly like the pattern that I will show you." The pattern was very important. Verse 39, a talent of pure gold is to be used for the lampstand and all these accessories. See to it that you make them according to the pattern shown to you on the mountain. It was very important that everything be made according to this pattern. Why? The answer comes in Hebrews 8, verse 5. Verse 5 says, the priests serve at the sanctuary that is a copy and a shadow of what is in heaven. That's why Moses was warned when he was about to build the tabernacle, see to it that you make everything according to the pattern shown to you on the mountain. It's a pattern of God's throne in heaven. According to Psalm 78:69, the temple was built after the pattern of the heavens and the earth. It says he built his sanctuary like the heights and the earth. Now, on top of all that is the obvious parallel between the fact that the centerpiece of all temple worship was the seventh day. And that's the day that God blessed in the creation of the universe. And not only that, another parallel. The phrase, the Spirit of God, which is a rare phrase in the first five books, the books of Moses. It only occurs five times in the whole Pentateuch. One of them is in Genesis 1-2, and it says the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters at the very beginning of the creation week, personally superintending the creation. The other four uses, two of them are in Exodus. Both have to do with the building of the temple. Both refer to Bezalel, who was in charge of the artistic craftsmanship in the temple. Exodus 31, listen to this. It says, then Yahweh said to Moses, see, I have chosen Bezalel. I have filled him with the Spirit of God, with skill and ability and knowledge of all kinds of crafts to make artistic designs for the work of gold, silver, and bronze, to cut and set stones to work in wood. The Spirit of God enabled Bezalel in the construction of the artifacts of the temple and the furniture of the temple, just as the Spirit of